We want to welcome you to this session. If you don't know, you're in session 232, titled The Roots of Mormon Correlation. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. We ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to the Sunstone magazine and podcast at the registration desk as well. Concessions will be open in the venue for lunch or you are welcome to visit local restaurants in the area. Please return by 1:45 to get a seat in the next session. This session is 60 minutes, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As you can see from your program, this presentation description is as follows. This presentation will explore the practical, theoretical, and theological underpinnings of the correlation movement, a bureaucratic reform movement that spanned the first two-thirds of the 20th century and reinvented the organization and culture of the church. Dr. Matthew Bowman is, as of July 1st, 2019, congratulations, the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University. Matt, we're excited to hear from you.
As you can see, I changed the title. Because I think this is going to... Well, I'm good. Yeah. I've been here anyway. Because I think this title gets a bit more at what I'm going to be doing here, which is asking, what does religion mean? Why do we assume some things are religious and other things are not religious? What is the difference between the religious and the secular? In particular, how does that question influence the way we think about the correlation movement? We're going to start with City Creek. I like this picture because it presents visually a kind of juxtaposition of something that many people took for granted, that is the temple and the shopping center. And now, of course, this is an open-air shopping mall that covers about 700,000 square feet, two full city blocks in downtown Salt Lake City, across the street from Temple Square. At the opening of City Creek, back in 2012, Thomas S. Monson, the president of the church, appeared, along with various local political and social dignitaries. And Monson was there because the church had assembled a coalition of financial backers and caused the mall to be built via something called Property Reserve, which is a subsidiary of the corporation of the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is one of two major corporations that structure the physical holdings of the church, the other being the corporation of the presiding bishop of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This mall is a really good example of what scholars mean when they talk about modernity, or what it means to be modern. The modern world is grounded in organization, in bureaucracy, in large-scale institution, and in empiricism, rationality, and we often assume secularism. The modern world is generally assumed to be secular. For the German scholar Max Weber, the rise of these things, the rise of science, the rise of empiricism, the rise of bureaucracy, of organization, led to what he called the disenchantment of the world. That is, the supplanting of the meanings and power of religion with the scientistic faith in human rationality. And many people have linked Weber's idea, that notion, that as modernity advances, religion retreats, to what's called the secularization hypothesis. the idea that this is inevitable, that as these modern ideas move forward, religion will necessarily retreat. Now, City Creek and this photograph calls that assumption into question. Here you see the president of a fast-growing, vigorous religion happily presiding at what seems to be a monument to the seemingly secular values of wealth, bureaucracy, organization. And indeed, the sociologist Armin Moss has linked the correlation movement, the rise of this church bureaucracy which led to City Creek, not to secularization, but to what he called retrenchment. That is, a renewed emphasis on the church's distinctive identity, the church's distinct epistemologies, the metaphysical power of its priestly authority, and the prophetic authority of its leadership. All of that in contradistinction to secularization. So what follows, then, in what follows, I want to explore this a little bit and unpack why it is that so many people associate the correlation movement with the secularization of the church, where that assumption comes from, and how the rise of the correlation movement challenges these traditional notions of secularization. My question essentially then is, how can there be a true religion store at the City Creek Center? I want to first give a brief overview of the correlation movement, and then address the ways in which the correlation movement challenged common notions of what was religious and what was secular in 20th century America. And then lastly, address how the correlation vision has interacted with modern issues, particularly issues of race, globalization, and gender. So let's talk first about the origins of correlation. Those two corporations I mentioned earlier, the Corporation of the President of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Corporation of the Presiding Bishop of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, both emerged in the 19-teens and 1920s, surrounding the presidency of Heber J. Grant, which spanned, of course, the 1910s to 1940s. And Grant himself is a useful illustration of the ways in which Mormon correlation illustrates the contested nature of the religious and the secular in the modern United States. He was born to a polygamous family at the height of Mormon isolation and separatism. He was himself a polygamist. And he embraced throughout his life Brigham Young's dream of a self-sufficient, independent church, separate from the United States in terms of economy and culture and politics. But at the same time, he was also a successful and well-known businessman. He had financial connections from San Francisco to New York City, and was often featured in the American media, as you see here, as a symbol of the American businessman. His structuring of the church and these two corporations was designed to foster both these aims. He wanted both to solidify the lines of authority and organization within the church, but also to make the church more comprehensible to American financial, legal, political institutions. He drew on ideas of scientific management, popular in the early 20th century. And by the early 1960s, the ball he got rolling had gained a lot of momentum. And his reforms were consummated in a concentrated overhaul of the church's organization and finances that began in 1961 and lasted until the mid-1970s. It was driven primarily by two men, the apostles Harold B. Lee and Nathan Eldon Tanner. They worked together. They valued words like efficiency and management, and they imprinted that style on the church. Lee was originally tasked with correlating the church's various auxiliaries, that meaning young women's, young men's, Sunday school, primary, the Relief Society as well, which meant initially ensuring that their curriculums were comparable and compatible, that they did not overlap too much in aims. He ended up reorganizing the entire church in such a way that augmented and emphasized the authority of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. The auxiliaries were placed under the control of the Quorum of the 12, which was divided into four major committees, which you see listed right there. Each of these committees had supervisory authority over certain parts of the church. the auxiliary's independence was eliminated. Their budgets were placed under control of the general church funds. Their publication divisions were shut down. Their independent decision-making processes is subject to review by the Quorum of the Twelve. Tanner brought similar reforms to the church's financial holdings. Having inherited a situation in which lack of accountability and fragmented departments had pushed the church close to bankruptcy in the 1950s. He sought to separate the church's ecclesiastical and income-producing holdings. He created a series of corporations, most notably Deseret Management Corporation and Property Reserve, to manage these divisions. He consolidated the church's finances and established a professional bureaucracy within the church's financial sector, a legal division, a real estate division, accounting division, and so on and so forth. In 1972, the church office building in downtown Salt Lake City was opened, a block from City Creek Center. It's 28 stories high. It houses roughly 5,000 employees hired to staff all these new departments. Among these were administrative offices like a publications division, a public affairs division, but there was also a correlation department which reviewed the products of all of these other organizations for orthodoxy, and that's very interesting. The presence of a correlation department alongside accounting and publications divisions signals something really key about the correlation movement, that it's not simply bureaucratic. It's not simply organizational. It produced a refined and standardized vision of Mormon piety, promulgated through art, through music, through orders of worship, generated by this new bureaucracy. City Creek, oddly enough, is a good signal for the metrics of this new piety, with this expensive furnishings and tasteful decorations. Like City Creek Center, the new Mormon piety was marked by the values and the tastes of the white American middle and upper classes. Through the early 20th century, Mormon leaders begin discouraging earlier charismatic forms of worship, tongue speaking, impromptu sermonizing. The correlation movement produced a common standardized hymn book featuring LDS and Protestant songs. It produced officially approved traditional representational art, handbooks directing worship patterns which emphasize reverence, reverence being a virtue developed and defined in the 1950s, meaning essentially the ability to sit still. Standardized chapel designs, expectations for business dress and worship, all of these things reflected a sedate and restrained piety characteristic of the white American middle class. It also means that we should understand the correlation movement as something more than simply a bureaucratic reform effort. It was, in a real sense, a spiritual revitalization movement, which, like other revitalization movements, was designed to confront a sense of spiritual crisis. That leads us to the next issue I want to address, which is the ways in which the correlation movement interacts with American notions of what is religious and what is secular. It's been common for a very long time in the United States, going all the way back to the 1830s, to judge Mormonism as something other than a religion. And in the 20th century and 21st century, accoutrements like City Creek have not aided the church's case. For the past few decades, it's been very common to see headlines and titles like these, right? Ominously warning that Mormonism is a corporation, not a religion. Caroline Winter, a reporter for Business Week, who covered the opening of City Creek, wrote that, quote, "Watching a religious leader celebrate a mall may seem surreal." Ryan Cragen, a sociology professor, concurred, saying that the church's diverse economic portfolio made it a business and not a religion. As Cragen said, as you see here, there are religious groups that own radio stations, but they don't also own cattle ranches. There are religious groups that own retreats, but they don't also own insurance companies. Given their array of corporate interests, it would probably make sense to refer to them as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Holdings Incorporated. The assumptions guiding both Winter and Cragen here should make us think about the nature of the religious and the secular in the United States. Scholars of secularism, like Talal Asad or Sabil Mahmood, have pointed out that contrary to the secularization hypothesis that I mentioned earlier, which maintains that the decline of religious authority is universally bound to the emergence of a modernity connected to science and technology, that is to say, in short, that as science gains authority, religion loses authority, secularism itself is actually an ideological construct on its own. There is no universal definition of the secular. The secular is simply the boundaries we place around what is religious. And thus, secularism is different in different times and different places. As Sabil Mahmood puts it, secularism is not the natural bedrock from which religion emerges, nor is it what remains when the religious is taken away. Secularism is a historical product with specific epistemological, political, and moral entailments. That is, what we say is secular really only illustrates what we believe is not religious. And different societies use that word in different ways. The secular is a particular way of defining religion. And we should then understand Winter and Cragen and all those headline writers as agents of a certain secularism. And a secular ideology derived from a particularly American and particularly Protestant way of defining religion. Many, many historians who write about Protestantism in the United States have linked those ideas to what scholar Tracy Fessenden calls a, quote, secularized Protestant culture, whose assumptions about everything from institutional authority to the very nature of the self are rendered normative in American society by a largely invisible Protestant framework. That is, how we define religion in America derives from the fact that this country is overwhelmingly Protestant. We assume that religions should be like Protestantism, and if they are not, they are not real religions. This Protestant framework is marked by ideas that emerged in the United States from really the 16th through the 19th centuries. The assumptions of common sense theology, which was a powerful Protestant ideology in the 18th and 19th centuries, it emphasizes the reliability of individual perception and individual rationality. It emphasizes the independence of the individual to make their own spiritual choices. It emphasizes that genuine religious experience is personal and interior, not exterior or linked to institutions. It is suspicious of institutions, generally. This is why, throughout all of American history, we have been marked by hostility to institutional religions, from Roman Catholicism all the way up through Scientology. These assumptions about human nature, about what real religion is, underlie American politics as well as American religion. If true religion preserves all of those virtues of liberty, of independence, of interiority, false religion destroys them. You can take, for instance, the Supreme Court case, Reynolds versus United States. This was the first case in which the Supreme Court rendered a judgment on what the religion clauses in the First Amendment mean. It also was a case about polygamy and whether or not polygamy was protected by the First Amendment. The Supreme Court ruled that, quote, upon marriage, society may be said to be built, and out of its fruits spring social relations and social obligations and duties with which government must deal. Polygamy leads to the patriarchal principle, and which, when applied to large communities, fetters the people in stationary despotism. The court then is saying, government has an obligation to enforce morality. Polygamy destroys the sort of morality that we like in the United States, and therefore government can regulate polygamy. These sorts of fears dovetailed through the 19th and 20th centuries with growing worry that modern bureaucracy, business, large government, industrial capitalism, these things were spiritually stifling. They were destructive of individual values and individual liberty. Karl Marx, of course, made this point many, many times over the 19th century, and many Americans, not even necessarily sympathetic to Marxism, absorbed his ideas that industrial capitalism alienated people. Industrial capitalism separated workers from meaning and value, and thus industrial capitalism was spiritually destructive. Throughout the 20th century, many American intellectuals, nearly all Protestant and nearly all sympathetic to anti-Catholicism, argued then that real religion could not be like industrial capitalism. Real religion could not be like business because real religion was personal. The baby boomers picked this up in the 1960s, and you saw it echoed over and over and over again in the critiques that the new left, the student protest movement, made against the federal government, which was waging war in Vietnam, which they made against the military-industrial complex, right, in which business and government colluded to destroy America's youth. They warned that the nation was controlled by dangerous large-scale institutions. And thus, by the 1960s, this generation began distancing themselves from institutions of all kind. Famously, sociologists have observed that membership in community organizations, things like the Kiwanis Club and the Rotary Club, have plummeted since the 1960s. And American churches have suffered as well. The sociologists Robert Wuthnow and Wade Clark Roof have observed baby boomers came to associate the word religion with institution, and instead embraced a new term that began to skyrocket in the 1960s, spirituality. Boomers begin defining religion and spirituality as opposed. Religion is something institutional. Spirituality is personal. Religion destroys these basic Protestant values. Spirituality enhances them. Now, I should point out, this is largely true of white Americans. The black church in America has continued to thrive, and this language has not penetrated as deeply into the black church. So by the end of the 20th century, these ideas were very embedded in American life. And the growing popularity of the word cult, targeted at groups that seem to violate these Protestant assumptions about what religion should be, is really illustrative. The word cult takes off in the 1960s and 1970s, applied to religions that were institutional, applied to religions with leadership, applied to religions that did not fit this Protestant model. The word cult really emerged from the conservative evangelical community. Evangelicals used the word cult to target new religious movements, primarily that seemed to them to be disruptive of evangelical values. One great example is this one, the Holy Spirit Association for the Unification of World Christianity, shortened Unification Church, better known as the Moonies. Sun Moon-mu was a Korean immigrant who came to the United States in 1972 and organized his church into a really vast, complex network of organizations, businesses, nonprofits, even newspapers. As his church grew and as it diversified, he began to be attacked. He was investigated by Congress several times. He was assailed by evangelical churches for being a business, not a religion. He was accused of being a Korean secret agent sent to the U.S. to undermine American democracy. And this language of cult was applied to him frequently. Now, the word cult comes with all sorts of associations. One does not convert to a cult. One is brainwashed, which is a word that is used by evangelicals to describe people who join these religious groups. One is not interested in genuine religious experience. One is suffering from deprivation of some kind. You had bad parents or you were poor, and that's why you would join a church like this. Cults were, as the Baptist leader Walter Martin put it, quote, heady stuff for the lonely, the weak, the confused, the intellectual, and mentally and emotionally ill. Cults are not real religions, then. And this term, of course, has continued to be used to apply to these religions. Now, I want to pivot a little bit. At the same time as this is happening, as baby boomers are moving toward the word spiritual, as the word cult is being used to attack institutional religions, other religious groups found the process of incorporation, of institution, of organization to actually be vitalizing and powerful. And one of the best examples of that is the Black Church. In the 19th century, many African American churches became the first churches in the United States to legally incorporate, that is, to become legal corporations. And they did this because incorporation legally protected and validated their very existence as independent congregations. Richard Allen, who was the founder of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, used the laws of incorporation to assert the legal independence of his church from white Methodist churches who sought to control him. They used incorporation then to assert the validity of their distinctive brand of Christianity. Similarly, the historian Timothy Glurg has explored the complicated relationship between the rise of modern commercial capitalism and conservative evangelical Protestantism. For them, bureaucracy, capitalism, these things explained how they understood the Protestant values of religion to work. For them, quote, society was an aggregate of rational individuals who approached their decisions identically in both the marketplace and a religious contract. God operated by a similar logic, creating as an engineer designs, communicating like a lawyer, and brokering relationships by contract. This is why, then, the mid-20th century was a great time of institution building for these Protestants. They founded radio stations, universities, publishing efforts, and forged an identity out of the word evangelical. The Mormon Correlation Movement did something similar. It managed the church's transition into modern institutional bureaucracy, but it also provided a distinctly Mormon religious language by which the church could internally resist the association of that transition with secularization. I want to talk about two religious concepts that the church used to make this bureaucratic reform religion. First, Mormon leaders declared that correlation was a mechanism of strengthening priesthood. In 1961, David O. McKay, president of the church, put Harold B. Lee at the head of the formidably named All Church Coordinating Council, which was an organization designed to pursue correlation. At an early meeting, Lee declared his guiding principle. He said, quote, our task is to bring the priesthood back to where it should be, according to Revelation, and then determine the relationship of the auxiliaries to the priesthood. The rationalizing possibilities, then, of correlation, of bureaucracy, extended the reach of priesthood authority. As the Apostle Bruce McConkie wrote, quote, if attempts are made to transmit the power of the gospel through auxiliary circuits or fringe committees appointed for specific purposes, the Lord's people are denied the blessings that a perfect organization would bring. Second, Mormon leaders describe correlation as an act of religious restoration. The notion that Mormonism is a restoration has been close to its identity from the beginning, but precisely what that means has changed over time. Is this restoration of doctrine? Is it about organization? For Harold B. Lee, restoration was about authority. And the notion of restoration, then, is closely linked to priesthood authority. As the bureaucratic power of correlation extended the ability of the church's priestly leadership to exert widespread authority over Mormon practices and beliefs all over the world, That authority is then connected to restoration. The policies, then, of bureaucracy are understood to be an act of restoring the church. This manual is an example of a restoration impulse. It was produced by the BYU religion professor Hiram Andrus in 1971. It is called Priesthood Correlation, the Lord's Battle Plan. And it connected the practices of the correlation movement to the ancient church. It included a timeline, which you see here, entitled the 7,000 years, stretching from Adam on the one hand to the millennium on the other, and you can't, unfortunately, quite see the end. It's on the next page. Marked on this timeline, though, are three Zions. You see two of them up here. The first belonged to Enoch. The second occurred in the Book of Mormon. The third Zion was designated priesthood correlation today. The thrust of this lesson is outlined in the text under this timeline. In each dispensation, the Lord has revealed a plan designed to make his people a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. The correlation program is not a man-made program, but a divinely revealed plan designed to augment the building of Zion and prepare this people for the coming of Christ. The lesson emphasized the connection between priesthood correlation and a perfect, divinely ordained society. Summarized in a rhetorical question. Do you know the reason why the city of Enoch was translated? It was because they had the correlation program of the priesthood. Here, the bureaucratic practices of correlation are thus linked to the early church. The seemingly, quote-unquote, modern ideas of bureaucracy translated into the restorationist language of the correlation movement. The correlation movement brought financial stability to a church that had for decades undergone wild, alarming swings from solvency to bankruptcy. It facilitated the stunning growth of the church, especially outside the United States in the 20th century. And, well, I want to argue that Mormonism generated an alternative modernity in correlation, one which took the seemingly modern ideas of institution, bureaucracy, rationality, normally associated with secularity, and instead sanctified them, made them into something that facilitated Mormon ideas about what it meant to be religious. I'm going to talk about a few examples of that. The first is the church's grapple with international growth. As we've seen, one aspect of this correlating impulse was to generate a new Mormon piety, a universal definition of what it meant to be, quote-unquote, Mormon, generated in Salt Lake City and spread through the reach of this bureaucracy. As one Mormon leader put it, quote, warning of the possibility that Mormon congregations overseas might cultivate their own styles of piety, quote, leave this alone and you get something contrary to the church. That is the way the Roman branch of the church took precedence. So you see, right, suspicion of Catholicism there. The first example of this I want to talk about is in Nigeria. Between the end of World War I and World War II, membership in the LDS Church doubled from roughly 500,000 to roughly 1,000,000, and it doubled again over the next 15 years. As the number of Mormons who lived outside the United States grew, and as their locations became increasingly diverse, church leaders were presented with a challenge. That is, what does it mean to be Mormon? Is what they're doing in Nigeria Mormonism? Why or why not? Now, throughout the 1940s and 50s, thousands of West Africans in what would become, in 1960, the nation of Nigeria, reached out to the LDS leadership. Some 5,000 letters arrived in Salt Lake City in those years. Now, Christianity, of course, had been gaining ground in Africa for more than 100 years, brought by colonial powers, and often adapted by Africans who made Christianity into something meaningful to them. The Africans who reached out to the Mormon leadership had discovered Mormon materials on their own, in magazines, for the most part. And they found particular Mormon ideas compelling. The notion of prophecy, the notion of a strong spiritual connection to one's ancestors, ritual worship in temples. These letters then described a version of Mormonism that emphasized its visionary, It's ritual. It's ancestral forms. As one man wrote, and this is an African, a Nigerian, writing to the first presidency, quote, "I have dreamt dreams of various degrees about the Mormon church. I have worshipped in the great temple with thousands of my brethren." Another Mormon convert, Emmanuel Kesey, reported that, quote, "In Ghana there are many prophets, so the idea of a prophet was not strange to me." Another, a man named Joseph William Billy Johnson, said that Brigham Young and Joseph Smith appeared to him in a dream and told him to seek out this church. Their letters requested missionaries, more materials, and further communication. Now, church leadership in Salt Lake City found these communications troubling. First, between the 1850s and the 1978, the church would not ordain men of African descent to priesthood office, and it would not allow men or women of African descent to participate in temple rites. For these reasons, the church had long avoided proselyting black people. This policy was justified with racist explanations and beliefs that black people were possessed of souls, less righteous than those of white people, that black people were the descendants of Cain, and so on. And while no single of these explanations was officially promulgated by church leadership, various Mormon officials repeated all of them, and they were mostly widely believed among both the laity and the leadership of the church. The church then did not only, and this is key, did not only restrict participation of people with African descent. Mormon rhetoric had defined Mormonism, a correlated Mormonism, in ways that rendered the sort of Mormonism these Nigerians imagined a false religion. Thus, Mormon leadership was disturbed when in 1960 a church official returned from Nigeria and reported that there was a congregation of Nigerians there declaring itself the Church of Jesus Christ the King of Latter-day Saints, and you see them right there. Rendell Mabee, one of the first missionaries to go to Nigeria, wrote that, quote, "Mormon leaders worried that self-styled branches of the church, established without divine authority, had incorporated without church permission under the name Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." You see here, right, Mabee's concerns that are wrapping notions of true up with incorporation and priesthood authority. Consequently, Mabee wrote, "We worry that Mormonism in Nigeria will be a confused mixture of the one true church and a loose collection of other congregations called by the same name." By the mid-1960s, there were about 15,000 of these people in Nigeria. Similarly, many Mormon leaders were worried by the patterns of worship they discovered in Nigeria, which seemed to them hardly Mormon. Dale LeBaron, a church official sent to Nigeria by the First Presidency, reported that, quote, "One of the great challenges for Joseph Smith was to counter the strange beliefs and practices which converts brought with them. Likewise, the first missionaries to Africa untaught many traditions, untaught drumming, dancing, rolling the collection plate." True religion, then, as the Mormon leadership understood it, required the Nigerian saints to embrace practices directed by priestly leadership, which was to say, the practices of the white middle-class American church. After Nigerian Civil War in the 1960s, the LDS Church began sending missionaries to the country with strict instructions. Chapels were built following the plans of chapels in the United States. The same hymns were used in Nigeria and in the United States. Organs were shipped to Nigeria for installation in these churches. The church faced a similar issue in Mexico near the beginning of the correlation period. In 1931, 33, 36, three conventions of local leaders in Mexico issued pleas to leadership in Salt Lake City for greater local autonomy, for material in Spanish, for more and better chapels. The Mexican churches were then governed through the missionary apparatus of the church, and the leaders of these congregations wanted a mission president of Raza y Sangre, that is, they wanted the Mexican mission to be run by native Mexican. When such requests were ignored, the leaders of the third of those conventions were excommunicated, and they led around 1,000 people out of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and into a schismatic movement, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Third Convention, that would persist for a decade. The Third Convention inspired Mormon leaders to link questions of race to questions of secularism. That is, coding the Third Convention's concern with racial issues as secular in such a way that made invisible how whiteness influenced Coalition's definition of religious. The convention was inspired in part by the nationalist sentiment of the Mexican Revolutionary period, which crested in the 1920s and 1930s. In these decades, the Mexican government outlawed any clergy who were not native Mexicans from entering the country. They banned the Catholic Church for a while. And Margarito Bautista, this man, one of the leaders of the Third Convention, argued that the Book of Mormon, whose narrative is described ancient American peoples called Nephites and Lamanites, taught that the indigenous peoples of the Americas should have primacy in the Church of Jesus Christ. As two convention leaders wrote to the First Presidency, quote, "The gospel our forefathers had, it is already restored, and it only remains that we, the Lamanites, be willing to do the divine will." White Mormon leaders rejected these ideas, defining Bautista's arguments as false religion. Leroy Hatch, a white Mormon leader born in Mexico, warned that, quote, "The convention is defiantly anti-Anglo. They certainly are not interested in the gospel." J. Reuben Clark, of the First Presidency of the Church, wrote to the Third Convention to, quote, "The expressions of a sense of injustice done to your people," end quote, derive from ignorance about church organization. As Clark said, quote, "Apparently you have not been fully informed of the way the church is built. Otherwise you would not have perceived there is no substance in or sound reason for these feelings of yours." Now, both the Nigerian saints of the Third Convention were eventually brought into harmony with Salt Lake City. In both situations, however, the process changed the church as much as it changed these outside groups in ways that expanded and contracted how Mormons thought about what it meant to be truly religious. As the church grew in Africa, for instance, David O. McKay grappled with the problem of priesthood. As he told his advisors, he believed God would have to instruct him to remove the ban on ordination, but he also wanted local congregations to become self-sufficient. And he sought to extend priesthood authority. He eventually reversed a policy which required all men in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, that is, to demonstrate they had no sub-Saharan ancestry. Instead, he directed these men should be ordained unless it was proven that they did have such ancestry. This narrowing of the restriction reflected, then, the gradual pressures of globalization upon the church. Similarly, the Third Convention remained very unwilling to give way as long as Salt Lake City used a heavy disciplinary hand. Eventually, church leaders appointed a man named Arwell Pierce, president of the Mexican mission. He was Anglo, but he instead sought to reconcile the Third Convention by seeking for them more local autonomy. He told them, "You should seek to form a stake, an independent organization separate from the missionary apparatus of the church." Pierce persuaded church president George Albert Smith to come to Mexico and meet with Abel Paez, who was head of the Third Convention. The two met at this meeting here. You see George Albert Smith on Paez's right. And more, the Third Convention, and particularly Bautista's ideas about race, contributed to a gradual resolution of a paradox within Mormon thought. Well into the 20th century, many Mormon leaders repeated a concept derived from Joseph Smith, the notion of believing blood. That is, Mormons believed those who joined the church were literally the seed of Abraham, a concept reified in patriarchal blessings, which the Smith family began to give in the 1840s. Bautista, of course, turned these ideas on their head. By his reading of the Book of Mormon, the true Israelites were the indigenous people of the Americas. Mexico will be the principal place, and Mexicans the principal people, playing the most important role in these last days, he declared. And indeed, the First Presidency, as they confronted Bautista and grappled with him, began to debunk the notion of believing blood to him. As Clark wrote, "You seem to consider that of all the church members, you yourselves are the sole possessors of the blood of Israel," Clark wrote. "Such an understanding of belief is contrary to the fact that the blood of Israel flows truly and universally in the veins of the whole membership of the church in all lands and in all countries." Right? So Bautista pushes Clark here to embrace a more universal notion than he had previously. Whew, okay. I have a little bit more time. So I'm going to talk about a third example, which is the issue of gender. It is unsurprising, I think, that because the correlation movement emphasized priesthood, because the correlation movement believed and argued that priesthood lay at the center of restoration, and because, of course, since the church's founding, only Mormon men would be ordained to priesthood office, that the process of correlation led to a marginalization of female authority in the church. Throughout the early 20th century, the leaders of the Church's Organization for Women, that is, the Relief Society, had immersed themselves in education and training in the burgeoning field of social work. In 1919, Amy Brown Lyman, who was a major leader in the Relief Society throughout the early 20th century, created in the Relief Society a social services department, which offered training in social work, organized professional social welfare programs, and involved itself in politics to lobby for legislation that Lyman believed was pro-family. For Lyman, this was all an aspect of being religious. Faith, she said, is to be generous to those in need and charitable to those of who are less fortunate. The achievements of the Relief Society of Women today stand as a monument to the power of their faith. But as we saw with the Nigerian saints and with the Third Convention, Mormon leaders turned the language of secularism on its head to delegitimate challenges to their priestly institutional authority. The Relief Society was perceived as secular, not solely because of Lyman's professionalization efforts, but because those efforts were not directed by priesthood authority. Chief among these critics was again J. Reuben Clark of the First Presidency. In a 1936 speech to the Relief Society, Clark said, "You have more or less taken on the attributes that are attached in the world to cultural clubs. We of the priesthood meet all these conditions. Do not try to be anything else but good mothers and good saints." Now, this is interesting, right? Because what Clark is doing here is viewing the Relief Society's work as secular because it is not associated with priesthood leadership. The scholar Joan Scott, a scholar of secularism, has argued that since the Enlightenment, the progress of how we understand civilization has been described in terms of binaries: the public and the private, the political and the domestic, the public and the individual, male and female, authority, submissiveness. Scott argues that in much of the Western world, our idea of what the secular is gendered. That is, she argues that the secular is often coded as male because it is associated with rationality and with science. And you see this, I think, in much of what's called the new atheism, which tends to be heavily male. People like Richard Dawkins, for instance, who make some gendered arguments like this, who talk about irrationality as being particularly feminine, for instance. Scott argues that looking particularly at attacks on the hijab in France, right now, the French state has banned wearing of the hijab because they see it as not French enough. Right? Scott argues that that ban reveals that the secular and the rational is coded as male and the religious and the irrational is coded as female because, of course, the hijab is something that women wear. Right? So women in France are religious, men are secular. Men are rational, women are irrational. Men are citizens, women are other, the outsiders, immigrants. That's how this ban defines this. Mormonism, I think, reveals a similar dynamic, although turned on its head. Here, the female is coded as secular. Clark argues that women participating in these worldly activities, like lobbying and legislation and social work, were female because they were doing it not under the direction of priesthood authority. And indeed, some leaders of correlation were very, very clear about this. Dale Moritzen, who worked for Lee, wrote, quote, "The whole tone of priesthood correlation seems to be the establishment of a divine patriarchal order." Right, arguing explicitly, right, that male leadership is religious, female leadership is secular. By the 1970s, the Relief Society's independent budget had been incorporated into general church funds. Its independent publishing arm was ended. And yet, I think we see more recently the rhetoric of correlation has also been used, the ways in which these Nigerian saints used it and the ways in which the Third Convention used it, to push these definitions that Mormon leaders were producing. In 2009, the Early Society president commissioned a book on the history of Early Society called Daughters in My Kingdom, which was distributed to all members of the organization. And the book asserted for the Relief Society the same restorationist pedigree that the Correlation Movement had assigned to priesthood. The organization of the Relief Society is an inspired part of the Restoration, said the book, whereby women in the church are called in ecclesiastical positions to serve one another and bless the entire church. This same organization existed in the church anciently. We could see this, I think, as less a historical claim and more a theological claim, because restorationist language was equated by correlation with priesthood, was equated by correlation with authority. Right, assigning this language to the Relief Society is an attempt, I think, on the part of these Relief Society leaders to assert power for them. When several years later, a group of Mormon women organized an active society called Ordained Women, asking church leaders to consider granting women priestly ordination, church leaders refused and excommunicated Ordained Women leader Kate Kelly. Soon after, Apostle Dallin Oaks asked that while women are not ordained to the priesthood, quote, we are not accustomed to speaking of women having the authority of the priesthood in their church callings, but what other authority can it be? We see here, right, Oaks trying to thread a needle to preserve this patriarchal rhetoric which undergirded Mormon claims to religious authority, while also seeking to widen what we can conceive a priesthood to be. So all three of these correlation stories of the Nigerian Saints, the Third Convention, and of the Relief Society, I think, tell us a lot about City Creek, ultimately, about what it means to be religious and what it means to be secular, about the ways in which our assumptions that we bring to these questions are shaped by our historical pedigree. In this room, our historical pedigree as Americans, and particularly as white Americans, who are shaped by thinking of the religious and the spiritual as dichotomies, the religious and the secular as dichotomies. In particular, I think the case of Mormonism reveals the fractured nature of secularism and religion in the United States. I referred before to an assumption common, I think, to many Americans, and many American historians in particular, that the American secular is dominated by basically Protestant ideas about what religion should be. As Mormonism illustrates, though, this is not quite true. There are many different secularisms in the United States. There are many ways of defining what the secular means, as there are multiple ways of thinking about what religion means in the United States as well. We are all, I think, undergoing and struggling, particularly, I think, members of this church, in two different overlapping circles, one being the church, one being the basically Protestant world of the American secular, which have different ideas about what religion and secularism are. And much of the tension, I think, that members of the church feel is when those two ideas come into conflict. And the story of correlation, I think, helps us understand that. So I will wrap up with that. Thank you for your time.
So we don't have a ton of time, maybe about 6 minutes or so. If we could use the mic here, that's standing over there, and then Matt can take a few questions from you.
I think they should use the mic.
Yeah.
Shall be recorded.
Yeah. Great presentation. Really enjoyed it. Do you dare make any forecasts of directions of the correlation and secularity and religion in the coming decades?
Sure, yeah. I think that one of the unintended side effects of the correlation movement, because I think a lot of the people who implemented correlation were blind to their own assumptions, its promulgation of this essentially sort of white, middle-class American form of piety is one of the major reasons why activity rates in the church outside the United States, and especially in the Global South, are so low. And you could see that coming, I think, with what happened in Nigeria, what happened in Mexico. There have, I think, been moves to decentralize a little bit, to loosen some of these reins, to allow different forms of Mormonism, different forms of Mormon piety to exist in these other countries. How far that may go, I'm not sure, but the decisions made there, I think, will have a lot to do with how activity rates in the Global South persist in the future, and really whether or not Mormonism remains an essentially American church, or whether it becomes a global religion, right? Something like Islam or Roman Catholicism, which is present all over the world and which has different forms and different patterns of piety in different places. Catholicism in Italy versus Catholicism in Mexico look very, very different. Right, and in part, that was a choice the Roman Catholic Church made to allow that to happen, to let this religion flourish. And that's the, I think, question confronting Mormon leadership right now.
Matt, you always impress. To call this a session on correlation really doesn't do justice to the scope of what you've done here. You suggested that the distinction between religion and business is a particularly Protestant construction. And that feels true to me, and yet Protestants have not been shy about being involved in business. I mean, every megachurch has a coffee shop,
yes,
and they sell fish bumper ornaments and WWJD t-shirts, and they have TV stations and radio stations and so forth. So I'm wondering, what is the line in the sand that they're drawing? What is the rubric that they're using to distinguish acceptable religious involvement in business from unacceptable, and what is it that puts Mormons on the wrong side of that line?
Yes, and this is, I think, there have been, I think, recent scholars of evangelicalism who have argued that this distinction is the real difference between conservative evangelicals, what we might call fundamentalists, and mainline Protestants. Right, the conservative evangelicals have, and you see Glurg's quote here, looked to modern capitalism and identified in modern capitalism certain values which enable those basically Protestant values that you see here. Personal liberty, independence, right? For these conservative Protestants, the business world is a place where those can be expressed, where liberty, independence, autonomy can be enacted. And they begin using, in the early 20th century, especially at a place called Moody Bible College, which is in a lot of ways the sort of the brain of modern Protestant fundamentalism, they start using business metaphors to talk about religion. And over time, those business metaphors become the language of this kind of Protestant way of talking. I think what this illustrates is what I said. There is no single thing called secularism, just as there's no single thing called religious. For some people, megachurches are too corporate, therefore they're not religious. But for the people who go to them, they see these values and the language being used there as expressing what they understand their religious to be. Right, it's a moving goalpost, secularism, and it's often, I think, a language and a rhetoric used to attack groups that the speaker doesn't think is really religious.
Thanks, Matt. Originally, I thought I was going to have a different question that was going to address more the historiographic aspect to your analysis, but that's changed.
Okay.
So, for me, listening to you talk and your presentation, and I'm sure, I don't know if this was intended or not, I'm going to guess that it wasn't intended, but listening to your discussions of the terms used to describe your topic, religion and secularism, so now I'm just wondering if you talk, well, see, this is how hard this is for me to try to figure out how to ask this question,
sure,
because they see it. Right now, they seem meaningless to me. They have no function. All they do is obscure and confuse. So that's left me feeling a little bit hopeless about future discussions of the things that you're talking about.
Oh, dear.
So I'm hoping that you could, I'm hoping that you'd be able to help me find the words to describe the dynamics that you talk about in your presentation. Since there just don't seem to be any, they're all they're meaningless.
I think it is useful to think about those two words, religious or religion and secular, as less things in the world than as rhetorical strategies. I mean, the term religion itself derives from Latin, and it's a real truth that as Europeans who are accustomed to thinking about religion as a thing that one did, as an organization that one belonged to, as Europeans encountered indigenous people all over the world, they were encountering groups that didn't think about religion in that way. So when the British reached India, for instance, the British really invented the notion of Hinduism. Hinduism is an English word. It is not a word used in Hindi or in the Indian subcontinent because they don't understand Hinduism to be a religion the way we define what a religion is. It's just something people do. It's part of their daily lives. Right? So if religion is a European concept, which it really is, it's a concept constantly in flux. And it's an argument that we're always having. Right? That's why the word cult, I think, is so interesting. Right? Cult is a word we use to designate something that isn't a religion because we think of religion as having some sort of respectability that we don't want certain groups to have. So we call them cults. Right? I tend to understand all of these terms than as rhetorics rather than objects, if that makes sense. Religion is a legitimating term. Cult is a delegitimating term. We tend to associate religions with congregations, with systems of belief that have been rationalized and organized and put together in some way. But then that raises the question, right? And this is a question the Supreme Court is always dealing with, right? Are Native American practices religious or not? Are the peyote churches religions or not? In Reynolds versus United States, the court ruled that Mormonism was not a religion because it practiced polygamy and therefore was not entitled to protection in the First Amendment. Right? So it's a term that is always changing, and I think being aware of the constant shifting of it helps us understand some of these arguments a little bit better. I hope that helped. Maybe it didn't. We can talk more about it afterward. Oh, we're a little bit over time, but I will take you.
I know we're out of time, yeah. But I just, I think the elephant in the room is the women's issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't begin with correlation, of course, but if you go back to the beginning of the Relief Society and of Joseph Smith's role in organizing it and so forth, mm-hmm. he didn't say, I turn the key in your behalf.
Yeah, to you.
Yeah, he mm-hmm. said, I turn the key to you, and yes. I'll make this organization an organization of priests and mm-hmm. Whatever and so forth. And gifts of the Spirit came ungendered.
Mm-hmm.
The women were blessing as, mm-hmm. and they were, couples were giving blessings and so forth. And as you follow that, there's been a number of things written about this, but I would just like to recommend the book Sisters in Spirit mm-hmm. that traces this yeah. whole women's thing from the Old Testament up to the present. And I do have an essay in there about mm-hmm. spiritual gifts. And it was just devastating to me to watch these eroded away
mm-hmm.
As the church leaders moved farther away from Joseph Smith and mm-hmm. knowing him. And then to watch, women picking up on these things and doing them, you know, without authorization and so forth. And then it was very clear to me that Joseph Smith meant the Relief Society to be a parallel organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I could speculate that had he lived long enough, women would have had the priesthood too.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not this,
yes.
it was this.
Yes.
And do you see that changing in any way?
Oh,
I mean,
in the future?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, I don't know.
Certainly not in my lifetime.
Yeah. I think one of the things that correlation did, and I wish I could have gone into this a little bit more, was to clarify and expand the definition of what priesthood is and to incorporate a number of practices into priesthood, right? And I think there's three we could talk about, one being spiritual gifts, one being ordinance work, and one being administration of the church. These are three different circles that early in the church's history were somewhat separate. And in the early 20th century, they start getting moved right on top of each other and all identified with priesthood. So the narrowing of female leadership in the church is a result, I think, of the clarification of priesthood and the definition of priesthood. That's something that I think exists on the subterranean levels of the consciousness of many people in the church, and thus evolution or change in it would require, I think, more awareness of that, which is, I think you're unfortunately right, is something that is not imminent. I'm sorry, Jose. We are 7 minutes over now.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Matt.